Blog Talk Radio.
All right, everybody. It's Monday, and that means another segment of the Constitution Hour. I want to remind everyone that's not in the chat room that we are made possible by PatriotFamilies.com. That is PatriotFamilies with a YS.com. I'd invite everyone to stop by the website, become a member of the family, and see what we're all about. I think you'll find that we've got a tremendous family, a great group of people, and all good patriotic Americans that want to restore this country back to what it was intended to be. And I see we've got a member in the chat, Ms. Terry Rowland. She also does a Blog Talk Radio show on Thursday evenings, the Education Hour. And if you get a chance, I would really encourage you to tune in to Terry's show on Thursday nights. It's at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. She does a wonderful job and a very lovely lady and very, very informative. So I just want to welcome everybody, and I see Yola has come into the chat room as well. Welcome aboard, Yola. Glad to have you here. As usual, I really don't have a planned topic for tonight. I typically don't. I just kind of go off the cuff. There's been a lot of things in the news lately. The weekend, unfortunately, or fortunately, however we want to look at it, was a bit of a slow news cycle. There were some things that came out with the ruling from a federal circuit judge in Michigan on the health care bill, as it were, and they didn't, of course, rule on the constitutionality of it or not, but they did, however, in that court hearing, agree that the states that were, or the parties that were bringing suit, had standing to sue. So that is one major hurdle when you're dealing with federal law, that the parties actually have standing to sue. One of the issues that I saw that the government, the federal government, is arguing in the particular case in Michigan is that the government has the right through the Commerce Clause to impose the health care bill on the several states. All of this, whether it's the Arizona law or the health care suit in Michigan or the one that has been filed in Virginia and is moving forward, I think the underlying thing that many are missing is they all pertain to the same subject matter, and that should be jurisdiction. They're missing the point as to whether or not Congress can stretch the meaning of the Commerce Clause to include people who are not engaged in commerce. I have no doubt that a good attorney or even a reasonably poor attorney could make a plausible argument that those people that stay out of the commerce stream with regards to insurance, nonetheless cause an impact on commerce, and therefore it would fall within the regulatory powers of Congress to do something about it. I think that argument can be made. I have spoken previously about the tax implication that the health care bill is simply a tax, the penalty, as it were, for not purchasing health care insurance or what the Congress would deem to be adequate health care coverage would cause the person to be subject to a tax. They can call it a penalty, they can call it whatever they want, but in the end, it is a tax, just like Social Security. And I don't think we're going to find any court in this country that is going to overrule the conventional wisdom regarding the taxing power of the federal government any more than I believe that we will find a court within these United States of America to overrule the commerce authority of the federal government. So if we put those two out of the way, I think what we're going to come down to is that it really hinges upon a jurisdictional issue. And there's some very, very good information and a lot of case law that establishes federal jurisdiction. And that alone, I think, is where we should be hanging our hats collectively as individual states in trying to fight this behemoth that's in Washington, D.C. We do need to bear in mind that the behemoth is simply a collection of individual state representatives and state senators. So we all understand the premise there that, allegedly we have that representation. The states are represented by the senators, and we, the people, the individuals, are represented by our representatives in Congress or the House of Representatives. Ideally, that's how it was supposed to work. Unfortunately, because of the 17th Amendment and the popular vote in regards to senators, I think a lot has been lost in that ideology, the initial plan of how things were supposed to work. And so we no longer have senators that are representing the state, although they do, of course, bring home lots of large pork barrel projects. And this leads to the chatter about earmarks and cutting earmark spending and just all these red herrings that come up. You know, when we look at the earmarks, if we just take earmarks as a total part of the budget, which is another red herring in and of itself, but the earmarks only constitute 16% of the total expenditures of the Congress in any given year. So the idea that cutting the earmarks is going to solve the problem is just a farce. It's absolutely nonsensical. But anyway, I'm digressing into all these other areas. Well, yes, Terry has just put up that the pretty little earmarks keep all the heavy contributors happy. And that's really what they are designed to do, is line the pockets of the corporatists that have invested in buying a senator, which is precisely what they do. We can call it, lobbying, if you like, but that's really a farce and I think an injustice to some of the honest lobbyists that are out there. And I know you all probably don't believe there are any, but there are some of us. In my home state of Georgia, there is a group of about 180 lobbyists, and not all of us are lobbyists anymore, but it's Lobbyists for Life and Liberty. You can find them at lobbyistsforlifeandliberty.org. We do have a website up now. It is fairly new, so there's not a lot of information on there yet, but it is growing by the day. One of the things that occurred here in Georgia is as our legislators saw the impact that the citizen lobbyists were beginning to have, because we saw that we had access, they promptly changed the rules in the ethics committee and created a $300 fee to become a lobbyist. So they're just trying to weed out the regular guys that aren't getting paid by some corporation to be a lobbyist. That's a tragedy, and it really speaks to the impact that our group was having, because we were in their face every day. Every day that they had a committee hearing and every day that our state legislature was in session, we had at least one person there, and typically 10 or 12 representing our group and really pushing to hold their feet to the fire. Just the mere fact that they went in and changed the rules, where it typically, previously, it cost $10 to register as a lobbyist, And that covered the paperwork fees and the cost of making your lobbyist badge that had your picture on it. Of course, they upped that fee to $300 as a way to discourage the citizen lobbyists. And I think that is absolutely despicable. And it speaks volumes to the fact that if you want to buy your legislator's vote, you're going to have to spend a little more money than $10. I really don't see any other way to look at it, you know. If you want access, it's going to cost you at least $300. And a lot of these people that were going down there, you know, they were going on their days off. Some of them didn't have jobs, or they were working part-time and trying to feed a family, and they don't have $300 to go and spend to become a lobbyist, and they're furious about it. So I got an email the other night in regards to it, and I'm going to be getting in touch with Rob Miller, who's one of the guys that is absolutely instrumental in keeping that group going. He's our techie and very articulate. I'm going to be getting in touch with him. I want to make certain that I do not fall off the rolls as a registered lobbyist. I do have a 2010 lobbyist badge that is still waiting for me down at the Sloppy Floyd building. That's where our ethics committee is at. So I have no problem personally paying that $300, but I know others do. So those of us that can, we need to become more active. I really got a lot of activity, or tried to become more active here and then a couple of other sites, plus working full-time. You know, it's tough. It's difficult to be in all places all the time. So really trying to dedicate and focus myself where I think I can have the largest impact. And I think all of us do that to some level or another. And I think this is why the family at patriotfamilies.com has been so very rewarding, because it's really a good group of folks. We have many members, but there is obviously a select group of people that are more active on our site than anywhere else. And of course, we always see them in the chats. And I think that's really what makes us a tight-knit group, a tight family. We understand one another. We don't always agree with one another, but we always respect one another. And it is very much like a traditional family, except we don't see each other. We talk on the Internet. But, you know, on getting back to this subject of jurisdiction, I think a lot of people have forgotten, and certainly Congress has forgotten, the limitations that were placed upon our newly found government regarding jurisdiction and how we could have a central government and yet have independent free states. And it was no small act that the founders drafted and put together in our Constitution, figuring out all the problems. And, of course, they learned legions of valuable lessons from the Articles of Confederation. And anyone that is involved in this research and, you know, figuring out what's going on in this country and in the world at large, I would certainly encourage you to read through the Articles of Confederation. I would also encourage you to read through our original charter with England. These are things that are important to understand, because they do, you see the development, the pathway that the founders were taking in guiding a path of freedom and liberty. And it gives you a more general purpose, what their purpose was, the mindset, what was in their minds, what were they trying to accomplish, something that had not been accomplished anywhere else on the face of the earth, to my knowledge, prior to that. And that was a constitutional republic, the Constitution being that document that bound the government and restricted it, and it was restricted to a specific area, a 10-mile square. And, of course, at the time, Washington, D.C. didn't exist, but they knew the outline of the plan had to be a 10-mile square area and nothing bigger. And now we see the federal government wants to extend its jurisdiction into the sovereignty of state territory where it has no business, where they do not belong. One of the most important areas of jurisdiction with regards to the Arizona debacle, and something I'm confused and somewhat surprised that I haven't seen anyone else pick up the ball and run with, is the fact that the Constitution authorized Congress to determine the naturalization status of people coming into the several states, and that after the specific date that Congress would determine who would be granted citizenship or not granted citizenship based on their presence within one of the several states. But you know, the interesting thing there is it does not prohibit a state from allowing a non-citizen to enter that state and take up residence there. That would be the state's sovereign right to determine and control all that is within its borders. Now, also, by the same token, the state would be able to reject or repel anyone from being within its state if that individual was not a citizen of another of the several states. There's clearly in the Constitution two areas that talk about sovereign immunity, the ability of the people to be secure in enjoying their rights, privileges, and immunities in every state of the union. And that is spoken of twice, once in Article 4, Section 2, and then again later in the 14th Amendment. And this is something I brought up to Yola the other day, and I posted a blog about. The problem began when the 14th Amendment was interpreted as extending the constitutional limits on the federal government to all the states through what was called the incorporation doctrine, that all the states were then incorporated into the federal government by the 14th Amendment. You got to stop and think about that statement for a moment. They don't state it in those terms. They couch it in very different terms. But I think the doctrine of incorporation and the 14th Amendment, we have to examine that pretty closely, because I think that the statement of the several states becoming incorporated into the federal state is a lot closer to the truth than any of us would like to believe. The federal government does not have the right to dictate to Arizona whether or not they allow illegal trespassers to remain on Arizona's sovereign soil. That is Arizona's absolute right. And in fact, Arizona has a duty and obligation to its citizens to protect it from invasion. And it can be seen as nothing but invasion if these people want to occupy the soil within the sovereign state of Arizona without permission. and against the law. It's just that simple, folks. Now, the dangerous part of that is that Congress may seek to grant citizenship to all of them, what we would call amnesty. I think they'll have a fight on their hands there, and they certainly are aware that that is a fight. But until Congress bestows upon those people the moniker or title of citizen, then they are not citizens. And while they may be afforded all the protections of the Constitution in terms of human rights, dignity, those God-given rights that our founders spoke of in the Declaration of Independence, that's all well and fine. However, they are not citizens, and therefore they can be asked to leave, and they can be forced to leave Arizona's sovereign territory without any other grounds other than the fact they're illegal. That's all that's required. Congress has not sought to bestow citizenship upon those people, mostly because they've not applied for it, or if they have applied for it, we all know the wheels of government turn slowly. That doesn't mean you get to jump the line and do as you please. This is just one of the areas where we really have a serious problem in this country. And the only way forward, in my mind, is for the federal government to stop interfering with a sovereign state and allow that sovereign state to enforce the law. Now, there is nothing in Arizona's law that is in conflict with the federal law. In fact, I would say that if the federal government wants to deploy agents such as border security or border patrol agents, they would necessarily need the border state's permission to grant that agency some kind of jurisdiction within the sovereign territory of Arizona. Now, at this point, it would be concurrent jurisdiction. That means it is a shared jurisdiction. I don't see why this is such a problematic issue. The rules are so very clear. And the only reason that I can come up with is that we want to continue the facade that the federal government is the supreme law of the land. And I think that's really the transformation that we've seen over the decades that occurred long before any of us were even born, quite honestly. It's just so plainly clear when you read the law. And Terry, I agree that it is a political football, but we should not play politics with the law. And I know that seems kind of oxymoronic, but it's true. It's absolutely true. When it comes to fundamental laws that have been long established with regards to jurisdiction, that should not be subject to political pandering. The state of Arizona was not given the authority by its citizens to give away its sovereignty. Wasn't given. It's not theirs to give. Now, the state can, by whatever means they put together, and that's up to each state to formulate their rules, the state can cede to the government, to the federal government, land or territories or areas for needful public things, forts, dockyards. Of course, we don't have to worry about dockyards in Arizona. But, you know, military forts and roads, post roads and that kind of thing. That was the purpose. And that was to provide a service. So it's very frustrating to see how we've got this transformation that has taken place. And yes, Terry, I understand most of the folks out there are only just now in the last year or so waking up to that transformation and the fact that it occurred at all. We have lived in this country our entire lives, and we've lived largely sheltered lives, not really delving into our duty and obligation as citizens and the history and understanding who we are and where it is we came from and what the purpose of our governmental system was. Most of us just didn't know. And quite frankly, most of us didn't care because it didn't affect us in any way. Or if it did affect us, it was in a very small way. And we certainly, you know, I know I always grew up, we've all heard that the only two things in life that are certain are death and taxes. But it's not supposed to be that way. Yes, death is certain, and some taxation is necessary. But we have devolved. I know we talk about progress and a growing economy. But folks, we have devolved. We've gone backwards. And anyone that doesn't believe that we've gone backwards needs to reevaluate how they measure success. We have gone from the world's greatest creditor and greatest innovator, the largest producer of anything and everything you could imagine under the sun. The U.S. was the largest industrial nation on the planet. We are now the largest debtor nation. The one thing that we make the most of is prisoners and debt. That's really a sad statement. One of the things that I've talked about has been the banking system. And, you know, a lot of these problems that we see in our nation today and worldwide, a lot of these problems stem from the same failed ideology. And that failed ideology is based on an economic theory that was put forth by one man. And it's called Keynesian economic theory. If you go back and read your history and you research World War I, World War II, you will see the rise of Keynesian economics. After World War I, there was a lot of economic turmoil, and that gave rise to the Roaring Twenties. And I know we've all read about the Roaring Twenties, but it also gave rise to an attempt at a gathering or a global governance called the League of Nations. The next thing that came about as a result of World War I was World War II. And what we saw in World War I, or at the end of World War I, and the attempt through the League of Nations, was for the first time we saw a collaboration of nation states getting together and trying to punish another nation state through economic means. So the collective good was going to punish the bad boy, and the bad boy was Germany, and it worked. They punished him severely, and Germany was absolutely crippled by the sanctions that were placed upon Germany after World War I. So along comes World War II, And after World War II, we create the United Nations. And along with the United Nations, there are two other entities that are created. Well, actually, several have come out of those. One is the World Bank, and the other is the IMF. Now, we hear about the IMF and the World Bank almost on a daily basis because of the financial strife that's going on in the world today. Very few people know where is the World Bank headquartered. Where would their headquarters be for the World Bank? Or how about the IMF, the International Monetary Fund? Where would we imagine they might be headquartered? You know, many people, Switzerland comes to mind right away. The fact of the matter is that both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are headquartered in none other than Washington, D.C. Small surprise there. So if you want to know where the influence is going, it's going towards the Capitol. There's a reason that they headquartered the World Bank and the IMF in Washington, D.C. and not in New York City or in Basel, Switzerland or somewhere else. These entities, the IMF, the World Bank, and there is another, the OECD, and there's a whole string of different alphabet gangs. Guys, I've heard for several years about a new world order and one world government. I got news for you. You've been living under it for decades. The United Nations deals with policy, public policy, humanitarian issues, declarations of war, which they're just as cowardice as our Congress, but they'll impose sanction after sanction after sanction, just like we saw in Iraq leading up to the first Gulf War and the second time around as well. But you have to stop and ask the question, who's funding both sides of the war? If Iraq, for instance, is under sanctions and no one's purchasing their goods, where are they getting the money from? Iran is a great topic. We know that Iran is in the news. We're all a tither because they're going to get nuclear weapons. Well, I got to ask you, if that really is the problem, if they truly are building these nuclear weapons, then why is the IMF, World Bank, and the OECD funding their nuclear power plant operation, the building of it? That's where they're getting the money, the loans, and the construction, the people, the materials. So you have to stop and ask yourself, how in the heck does this happen? Go look at who the top members are in the IMF. You might be surprised or not surprised to learn that our own Timmy Geithner is the head of the Board of Governors of the International Monetary Fund. Amazing. Curious how it is that someone who holds a cabinet-level appointed position, such as Treasury Secretary, has allegiance to another group and another banking interest in the International Monetary Fund. I really don't understand how that's plausible under our system of government. Guys, we're running a dual system, and you're being hoodwinked. I've told everyone here before that monetary policy coming out of the Federal Reserve Bank is dictated by the IMF. And who is the IMF? Well, the lead guy at the IMF is none other than Tim Geithner. And the backup to Tim Geithner at the IMF is none other than Ben Bernanke. I mean, it's all the same people. They're all coming out of the same system. It's all out of the central banking system. And they know that they've got you enslaved. They've got their chains on you, and you're not getting them off. That's why this is how you can have 325 members of Congress co-sponsor a bill with almost no opposition to it from Congress at all, and the bill never gets passed. Of course, the bill I'm talking about was Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed. It was killed, destroyed, demolished, dismantled in the Senate, and it came out with no teeth, and it was nothing. And then what happens? We get the financial reform bill that grants more power and authority to the central bank, the Federal Reserve Bank. It's insane. I don't know if I'd call it socialism, what's going on with the banking system. It's monopoly, and it's a system of slavery. And I think it's even more onus than socialism, Marxism, communism. It's anti-humanism. They control all of it, guys. And I hate that I always digress back into the banking system. But it's the truth. It's absolutely the truth. Congress does not run the central bank. The central bank runs Congress. And Obama probably didn't have a whole lot of choice in who he had to appoint as Treasury Secretary. Not that I want to give any alms to Obama whatsoever. He has his own agenda, but he has to stay within the agenda of those that govern him, and that is the banking system. Well, in our system, Baroness Margaret is posting on here about individual wealth for everyone, and that is a wonderful concept. That is the concept of capitalism and a free market system. Unfortunately, we don't have individual wealth in our system. All the wealth in our monetary system is debt. And every person that goes to work every day, whether they pay taxes in at the end of the year or whether they get back everything they paid in and then some, they are all bearing the burden of paying for someone else's wealth. It is absolutely despicable, and it is, in no uncertain terms, slavery. The biggest difference is that we don't recognize that it's slavery. We believe the lie. We believe that, hey, look at this. I got a new credit card. My credit means I've got $10,000 credit line. Why do you think they spend millions and millions of dollars putting on these commercials about your credit report, your credit score? My God, your credit should be the most important thing in your life. Horse manure. If everyone in the U.S. trashed their credit rating, the banks would find a way to restore it because they depend on us wanting their product. They absolutely depend on our willingness. I mean, honest to God, you know, I watch some of these TV shows every now and then, you know, these ice road truckers, and people will absolutely risk their lives for what the banks are peddling, paper debt. It's insanity. But yet they won't risk their lives to stand up for their own freedom. They won't risk their lives to stand up in defiance of the system. That's what we need. We've got to have that defiance. And I don't mean armed rebellion. That's just ridiculous. People that talk about that. Yola, I see your light bulb just popped on. I love it. It's an amazing moment when it all clicks. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. It's so difficult to wrap your mind around because we've been taught to believe 180 degrees the opposite of what is factually true in reality. We have been led to believe a complete and total lie. Now, we throw in some good little feel-good stuff here and there because it makes us all warm and fuzzy. But it's all on credit. It's all crap. It's all debt. And that's why these countries now, it reminds me of a bunch of gangsters sitting around a card table playing cards. And nobody trusts the other guy sitting next to him. And that's exactly what you're seeing going on worldwide right now. Germany doesn't trust France. France doesn't trust Spain. Spain doesn't trust Greece. They all know it's bullcrap. They all know it's a bunch of junk and it's all debt. And when the people, this is the important part, when the individual people begin to lose faith in the lie, we see the problem that we have now. The people are the ones that are in control of this system, and they don't even know it. They just don't even recognize it. And the bankers, the ones that are up there dictating to everyone, they don't want you to know it. That's the secret. That's the lie. Because no matter how badly they want to decouple the market from reality, no matter how badly they want to decouple the market from a gold and silver standard, they can't. Because even the bankers in times of distress run to gold and silver. And the reason for that is that it is steady and constant. And you can't just run down to the bank and print up 5 tons of gold. You can't do it. So that is the only thing that keeps them even remotely honest. But what we need to kill this thing... Well, yes. The bankers have made themselves, in our minds, necessary. The banking system as a whole, worldwide, has perpetrated the lie, and we have believed the lie, that we need the banks, that the banks provide a necessary function. Well, banks don't create anything except debt. And they extend that debt to anyone who wants it. It is absolutely insane. If we can't figure this system out and figure out that we need to stop supporting it, then we're destined to stay in the system. No matter who is sitting in the White House, no matter who is sitting in the head at the Kremlin, no matter who is sitting on the throne in England, it just doesn't matter. The only thing that will bring true growth and prosperity to any nation around the world is a free, honest market system. Now, certainly, there's going to be crooks in any system. There's always going to be thieves. There's always going to be carpetbaggers. But an honest system is going to make it a whole lot easier to track down those scumbags than it is now. Look at the mortgage mess. And notice again that we're being focused on the mortgage, the housing crisis. They have created such a volume of false paperwork, bogus documentation. Guys, they have created a system that they've told so many lies they can't even remember them all. They can't find the truth. They absolutely cannot. Now, my father called me today and just wanted to give me a pat on the back for something that I had told him about over a year ago, and that was this MERS system, Mortgage Electronic Recording Management System. What happened is that, you know, traditionally, when someone got a mortgage on their home, the bank or a representative, a lawyer, would go down to the county courthouse and they would file a lien and file all the appropriate documents with the county clerk in the recorder's office. And they would record that lien on the abstract in the property for the deed, the title to the property. Well, what the banks and the lending institutions found out is that they could create a mirror system on the internet, one that was electronic. So for every loan and every document that they could go down to the courthouse and file physically, they could also create one electronically. Well, only the bankers and mortgage brokers knew about the new system. Well, they were able to create ghost loans. So if you had a $200,000 mortgage on your home, they could file another mortgage document on the new electronic system that looked identical to your mortgage document, creating an entire new mortgage on the same property. Big time scam. Well, they got to selling these things on the market, trading them. That was part of these CDOs that we heard about. Collateralized debt obligations. Well, for every mortgage that was in the real system, they were creating a mirror, a ghost. So they were doubling the amount of mortgages in these CDOs. And this is why people's paperwork has been completely lost. Because now, when they printed up this junk and packaged it all together, they can't keep track of the real stuff from the bogus stuff. And when they go into court, absolutely, Terry, like a bookie laying off bets he didn't take. When they go into court now, the whoever is allegedly the holder in due course, some sharp lawyer up in Ohio started this mess and said, hey, Your Honor, we want documentation. We want to see the original contract signed in ink. After all, that is the law. Well, guess what? They couldn't produce it. They can't find the damn thing. It's probably sitting in a warehouse over in Singapore somewhere. So now they've got another problem. Courts aren't going to let them foreclose on these houses without the original documentation. And what they've been presenting is bogus. And in many cases, these MERS generated bogus loans. And all of this, yeah, absolutely. That is exactly right, Terry. This is why they're putting a hold on all foreclosures by Bank of America. Now, if you want to know who the guilty parties are, they're telling on themselves right now. The ones that jump out real quick and volunteer to put a moratorium on their foreclosures, they're already telling you, we know we're guilty, so we're just going to bypass having Congress force us to do it, and we're going to do it on our own. That's the beauty of capitalism and a somewhat free market is that the bad guys try to cover their tracks as quickly as possible, and when they do, they stand out like a sore thumb. But, you know, the other side of the issue on the mortgage that has not been covered in any depth is the fact that the original mortgage is also just as bogus and just as fictitious as the one they're creating in the MERS system. And that's because the bank can never show where the funds to fund the original loan came from. They cannot show a paper trail for the origination of the funds that they loaned you. It's because they never loaned you any funds. They simply said they did and made an electronic entry on their books. The money never existed. Eventually, this too, I believe, is going to come to light with all that's going on in the housing system. And I think this is what they're really fearful of. The whole thing is a house of cards, and all the debt is created. But it all is our credit, our willingness and ability to repay that debt. The problem is that there's only consideration being given on one side of the contract, and that is on the side of the debtor, the person repaying the imaginary loan. The bank risks no capital. There is not, they put up no risk, zero, none. And until we can figure this stuff out, guys, we're still going to be lost. I'm very, very encouraged at Yola's remarks tonight, because I know that the light bulb went off, it clicked, and now she gets it. And that is just so encouraging. I love it when I see that light go on and you go, aha. When it all clicks, then it all begins to make sense. And when it all begins to make sense, then you understand just how lost everyone else is when they're trying to look at this stuff. I mean, it's absolute insanity. And the bankers, you know, the guy that runs the local bank down here, your bank president, he knows it. He doesn't want to talk about it. And he gets paid very well. The other schmucks, the schmoes, the regular folks at the bank, the teller, the manager that takes care of this or that, they don't know. They don't know anything. They know what they're told and they do their job. We're the ones that give credence and credit to this whole system. And we're also the ones that can take that away from them. And it's really simple. It's so simple for us to just walk away. My fear is that we are addicted to the system. And we don't know how to do anything else. And what you're seeing take place right now in our political spectrum is a fight. And that fight that you're seeing right now, and that fight includes a good number of us, it's simply a fight for the best way to save the system. Exactly. Margaret Thatcher, you're exactly right. It is all about the money. All this upheaval, everything going on worldwide, but in this country right now, all the infighting between the Republicans and the Democrats, the split of the parties, all of it, and all of the Tea Parties and everything else, what most don't realize is we're just simply arguing over the best way to rescue the failed system. Why rescue it? I don't want to rescue this system. I want to go back to the system that existed prior to the Federal Reserve Bank. That doesn't mean I want to go back to slavery. That doesn't mean I want to go back to, you know, lynching people on the street corners. But we've got to come to a point in this country where all the folks that are involved in the Tea Party movements and the Patriot movements, where we can sit down and have an intelligent, rational conversation about an actual solution to what has been created in the absence of freedom and an honest monetary system. There's no doubt that the problems are enormous, but they're not insurmountable. And we can restore honesty and integrity into dealing in commerce, business dealings. But the only way we're going to manage to accomplish that is to get government in large part out of that. That brings us full circle back to the opening comments about commerce and jurisdiction. Our Constitution, we the people, gave our elected government the authority to regulate commerce. That means to make regular. Every one of you, if you're doing what you should, and probably most of you aren't, you regulate the air pressure in your tires. The purpose of that is to make sure that your tires are full of air. Make sure that they're aired up and right where they should be. It's not to make sure that one tire gets more air than the others. I don't know how more plainly I could state that. Government was not supposed to be in the business of being a business. We can go into our law and find that the United States is a federal corporation. It has no business being a corporation. It has no business being in business. And it has no business dictating to businesses any kind of price controls. Regulation was supposed to make sure that business was equal across the board, equal opportunity for all forms of business from state to state to state. That was the purpose of it, nothing more and nothing less. We have allowed the Commerce Clause to be stretched, twisted, and expanded to the point that there's no portion of any creature's life upon the face of this earth that cannot be regulated by commerce, by the Commerce Clause, by our Congress. It's absolute insanity. Guys, I know, you know, I've heard a lot of folks, again, asking for, you know, what do we do? What are the answers? Stop participating. Stop giving your consent to this damned system. And I know it sounds crazy, but you know what? If everyone in the Patriot movement and the Tea Party movement went out tomorrow morning and closed all their bank accounts, cashed them out, first of all, they wouldn't be able to get any money because the banks don't keep that kind of money around. But if we just pull our money out of all the banks and let them go away, we could deal with one another without a go-between. We really can. And we can force Congress to go back to constitutional money. That doesn't mean they have to mint silver coins. There has to be some kind of backing behind them. But they can print U.S. notes. We've done it in this country before. We can fix it again. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got just a scant few seconds remaining. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and listening and all the comments going up. Baroness Margaret Thatcher and the Paulding Pundit, Yola, Pops, I see my dad, Tom is on here, Terry. And I want to thank all those listeners that I can't see but are listening that aren't in the chat, and invite everyone once again, please come by patriotfamilies.com, join up with the family, and see what we're all about. That's patriotfamilies with a YS.com, And everybody, thank you for tuning in. Great show. God bless everyone. Good night.